When we use the internet, we're entrusting tech companies with some of our most private information, including our conversations, photos, even our locations. These companies have promised they'll keep our data safe. But what happens when the government comes knocking at their doors?
For the past year, the Department of Homeland Security has been asking tech companies to unmask protesters and others who have criticized the government online. When challenged, the government has dropped their unlawful demands. Some internet users, however, are never given the chance to say no. I'm Hudson Hongo.
And I'm Christian Romero. This is Effector from the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Later, Christian will be giving a quiz to test just how much we all know about our digital rights.
We'll also let you know about some of the upcoming opportunities to connect with EFF.
But first, we'll be talking about Homeland Security's lawless demands for user data and how tech companies do and don't have our backs. So today we're talking about really one of the most important questions, I think, in digital privacy, which is what happens when law enforcement asks for your data from a tech company that has it in its possession in some way or another? Is this something you ever think about, Christian?
I mean, honestly, not often. And I kind of feel like that's the way it should be. But after seeing the story we're going to talk about, it's on my mind more than I'd like it to be.
Right. You use an internet service or another, they have information on you. And any kind of information like that becomes like pretty attractive to, in this case, we're talking about law enforcement.
Yeah, some of the information they collect doesn't sound as spooky as you'd think. They're not collecting like the text of your communications if you're using end-to-end encryption and stuff. But like, you know, you think about your IP address or when you were logged on, it can really paint a pretty clear picture of possibly who you're talking to, where you are, where you live. Not my favorite thing to just be handed out willy-nilly to whoever asks for it.
Right. And because this data can be so revealing, EFF has actually for years tracked how different companies respond to government information requests on a company-by-company basis. This was especially interesting in the years following the Edward Snowden revelations. And in those years, sort of after that, there was a lot of progress, particularly with what we're talking about today, which is when the government does come to a tech company requesting this kind of user data, does the company tell the user? And this is really important because sometimes those demands for data are illegitimate. And if you know the government is asking for your data, you can like take them to court. You can challenge this request.
Yeah. And a lot of tech companies, including one we're going to talk about today, Google, has stated in the past that they will give you notice.
Right. And I said, you know, there was a lot of progress sort of made in the post-Snowden revelation years. But today in 2026, there are new threats to privacy from the government, which is putting those promises made in that era to the test. Particularly, we're talking about these Homeland Security administrative subpoenas. Have you been following these, Christian?
These were really put on my radar after our recent blog posts, and now I'm paying attention a lot more, yeah.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about those in just a bit. An EFF client was actually the target of one of these subpoenas from Homeland Security to Google, and he wasn't given any advance notice despite what Google has promised. Through this, we found out alarmingly that he's not alone, that it's actually sort of a bigger problem. So to explain just what it is we discovered, I talked to F. Mario Trujillo, a senior staff attorney at EFF. Let's listen into our conversation. Well, hi, Mario. Thanks for making the time to chat.
Yeah, good to be here.
So I wanted to talk today about a hidden practice that betrays an important promise Google makes to its users, including an EFF client, Amanda Thomas Johnson. But to explain how we uncovered this practice, I think we have to start with the Department of Homeland Security and their recent attacks on the First Amendment. Can you describe the recent pattern we've seen with Homeland Security and subpoenas for user data?
Yeah, sure. I think in the last year, we've seen the Trump administration attack free speech in a number of different areas. But one area is the Department of Homeland Security sending out these administrative subpoenas to a broad group of people who are either engaged in speech against immigration activities, who are maybe tracking law enforcement activity inside their communities, or actually international students who perhaps have attended a protest in the past and the government doesn't like that. And so they're trying to deport those individuals. And so we've seen the Department of Homeland Security trying to get information from tech companies about those individuals, one, in an attempt to either investigate them, but also probably just to harass them and maybe intimidate them.
So can you give any specific examples of these subpoenas and the accounts targeted by them?
Yeah, sure. So in one case, our client, Amon LaThomas Johnson, he was an international student at Cornell University studying for his PhD. In 2024, he attended a Palestinian protest for about 5 minutes. Flash forward a year later, the Trump administration comes into office and is trying to deport a lot of international students who have attended these protests in the past. And so the Department of Homeland Security sends out a number of administrative subpoenas targeting either Amanla or, colleagues of his or other people who have attended these same protests, trying to get their information, maybe trying to get their address or their general location so they can be perhaps tracked down and put into deportation proceedings. And so in the case of Amanla, DHS sent a administrative subpoena to Google asking for Amanla's basic subscriber information like name, email address, IP address. Google has policies to say like, hey, if we get this notice from the government, we'll let you know. And if you want, you can challenge it. Google didn't do this in this case. And so Google sat on the subpoena for about a month and really didn't take any action. It didn't tell Amanla. It didn't sort of comply with the subpoena. It just kind of did nothing for about a month. And then I think after about a month, it realized, hey, there's this subpoena. We haven't done anything with it. And so to rush it out the door, they complied with the subpoena. And on the same day, they told Amanla that they had already complied with the subpoena. And so he really didn't have any sort of opportunity to challenge the subpoena on his own.
So, and to be clear, these administrative subpoenas, they're not necessarily backed by a judge, right?
No. An administrative subpoena is essentially just a piece of paper asking a technology company to do something. It does have some force of law behind it. You know, these tech companies get tens of thousands of subpoenas a year, and most of them are usually valid. But with these kind of administrative subpoenas, when they're targeting a user just for the speech they engaged in or them attending a protest, that's beyond the scale. And particularly with these DHS subpoenas, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has a sort of narrow range of things that it can investigate. And many of the things that they're subpoenaing for, they actually don't have authority to investigate it.
Speaking of patterns, there's also been a bit of a pattern when these DHS administrative subpoenas have been challenged, correct?
Yeah. So we know of at least four administrative subpoenas that have been sent to Google, to Meta, to Reddit. And each time that one of these has become public, those individuals who have been the target of the subpoena, they have found lawyers, they have gone to court to try to quash those subpoenas. And even before a judge gets to rule on this, DHS withdraws the subpoenas. You know, when they finally get dragged to court, they won't even stand up in front of a judge and try to defend these because they know how lawless they are. And so they have just withdrawn them.
So as you've said, EFF's client, Amanda LaThomas Johnson, was the target of one of these subpoenas. His outcome was a bit different, right? Just to hammer it again, what made his situation different?
Yeah, so in all of the cases that I just talked about, either Meta or Google or Reddit, for 10 years, they've had these policies that say, if we get a demand from the government for your information, we will let you know beforehand. In case that subpoena or that search warrant is invalid, you can go find a lawyer and you can challenge it on your own. You know, these tech companies should probably be challenging the subpoenas on their own anyway, just to protect users' rights. But, you know, they can or cannot do that. They usually don't. But what they do promise to do is to give the users notice. And that didn't happen in the case of Amanda Thomas Johnson. Google sat on the subpoena for a month. It tried to rush the subpoena out the door once it realized that it was kind of late. And rather than giving that promised notice to Amanda so he could look it over, find a lawyer and challenge it like all those other four people did, Google just turned over his information. And so once Amanda found out that this subpoena existed, Google had already complied with it. So there was really nothing he could do to try to claw it back from ICE.
Can you describe some of the data that ICE asked for?
Yeah. So these subpoenas really can only target a narrow set of information. We're not talking about the content of communications. We're not even talking about sort of the metadata about who you're contacting. Instead, it's called basic subscriber information. And so usually it is name, email address, IP address. Sometimes they can request session times. And so even though this seems like very basic information, in the right hands, it can be very worrying. If you're trying to unmask an anonymous user online, getting their name is a lot of information. If you're trying to track down an international student who attended a protest and you're trying to deport that individual, their home address is a very important piece of information. And so is their IP address that gives their general location. And so even though this is, much less revealing than the content of communications, it is still a very large investigative tool for the government, which, they're getting without any sort of court authorization. It's just essentially a mid-level DHS employee signing a piece of paper and giving it to Google. That's essentially what an administrative subpoena is.
So, right. Google has this promise they've made to users that it will notify them before they comply with law enforcement requests, except for in some very narrow exceptions. That's not what happened here, which isn't the outcome that's supposed to happen. But as bad as sort of Amandla's case is, you later found out that this wasn't necessarily a one-off situation, that there's a more systemic practice. What were you told?
Correct. Yeah. So, yeah, the basic thing is Google has made this promise for 10 years that it will give notice. In Amandla's case, it broke that promise, and there were real consequences. His data is now in the hands of ICE. That's bad enough. But when we talked to Google about this, and we asked them, was there a gag order ordered by a court? Is that why you didn't notify him? Was this his university email address and you notified Cornell and not him? Like what happened? They essentially said, we get a lot of requests. We get tens of thousands of these subpoenas every year. They didn't say this explicitly, but I think the tone was sometimes they fall through the cracks. And sometimes, we get a request. We have 10 days to respond. Sometimes we kind of forget about responding to them in that 10 days, and we look up, it's a month has gone by, and we try to rush it out the door. And so in order to rush it out the door, rather than giving that promise notice to our users, sometimes we just don't. And sometimes we give a thing called simultaneous notice, which means that they disclose the user's information to the government and notify the user at the same time. And so that kind of cuts the sort of the purpose of advance notice out at the knees, because the purpose of advance notice is, you get to look at the subpoena, you get to challenge the subpoena before your information gets turned over to the government. And that was the thing that what was missing here. And so, we know of this one case, Amandla's case, Google clearly screwed up. We just don't know how big the problem is. Google has billions of users. It gets tens of thousands of these subpoenas. It's likely that this happens much more frequently than we know about. And I think that's like the main question to be asking Google, either if you're a reporter or if you're a sort of government investigator. It's just like, how often is this happening?
Speaking of the government, last week, EFF sent complaints to the attorneys general of California and New York. In those letters, what are we asking them to do?
Yeah, we're asking them to do two things. So one, open an investigation, and then probably bring an enforcement action for under this sort of statutes that are known as unfair and deceptive practices laws. Under these statutes, if a company in a business setting makes a statement that is material, and then it sort of violates the promise of that statement and harm occurs, then that is sort of a deceptive practice. I think you generally see this more in like advertising. Perhaps in an advertisement, a company advertises its products as doing X, Y, and Z, and those products actually don't do that. That's usually where these unfair and deceptive practices act claims come from. But in the privacy world, many of the claims that are made in companies' privacy policies have been enforced under the statute as well. And so that's essentially what we're asking both the California Attorney General and the New York Attorney General to do. Just open up an investigation, see how broad the problem is. And if this problem is as broad as we think it is, to bring an enforcement action against Google to make sure this doesn't happen in the future.
Yeah. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but right, this is like exactly why Google makes this kind of privacy claim, right? There's a way it's supposed to work. Maybe they get an invalid law enforcement request. You have the advance notice, you can challenge it. And if you read Google's policy page, this is how you would expect it to work. And now we found out they have something that they call simultaneous notice, which obviously completely takes away the ability to do that.
Yeah, correct. I think it's very important to understand that, like, Google made this promise. Many other tech companies made this promise a decade ago to try to win back and gain back the trust of their users. You know, this is go back 10 years. This is a time, you know, a few years after the Snowden revelations, where there is wide-scale allegations that tech companies sort of helped facilitate this mass spying on a sort of global level. A lot of tech companies had lost a lot of trust in their users, and organizations like EFF and others had really pushed these tech companies to do more to protect their users at the forefront. We pushed them to, you know, challenge some of these invalid subpoenas or search warrants on their own. They didn't sort of take us up on that. But one thing that they did take us up on was, at the very least, just give your users advance notice so they can go out and find a lawyer on their own. And that's a very hard thing to do, but many people end up doing it if the notice gets to them in time and with the proper information. And so it's really a basic thing that Google has promised for a very long time to try to win back users' trust. And now we're finding out that that promise isn't always followed through.
Right. So the tech companies have a really important role here. You took us back to a particular time when people were thinking a lot about government attacks on privacy of individuals. Now we're in a different context where the government is attacking privacy and constitutionally protected speech. So now that we find ourselves here, what should Google and other tech companies be doing?
Yeah, I think the first thing they should be doing is just taking a harder look at these Department of Homeland Security subpoenas in general. I think the tech companies should just look at these subpoenas with a layer of skepticism at this point. I think DHS has just proved that it's not an honest broker in this area. Four subpoenas have been challenged in the last 6 months. Four subpoenas have been withdrawn. And so I think tech companies just have to understand that DHS, you need to look at these subpoenas with a level of skepticism. And so I think that's the first ask that we've been making, and we're hoping that the tech companies are hearing us. But the second ask, and it's like the bare minimum ask, is just like, you've made this promise to your users. Make sure you fulfill that promise. Give your users notice so they can come to the EFF or ACLU and try to fight these subpoenas on their own. I mean, that is the bare minimum that they could do.
Well, thanks again for stopping by, Mario. So, Christian, pretty alarming situation. Did you read Amandla's blog post about his ordeal?
I did. It was a really impactful read, for sure. Seeing this from the perspective of someone who has been affected by these subpoenas, it really paints a clear picture of how invasive these can be, and also how just scary it can be to receive an email that's like, hey, by the way, we've given a bunch of your data to the government. Just an FYI, by the way, no heads up,
right,
no,
right.
Nothing.
So if anybody listening hasn't read this blog post, I recommend they do. We ran it on our website under the headline, Google Broke Its Promise to Me. Now ICE Has My Data. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, these things, they can sound so ethereal, diffuse. Oh, data requests, handing over data. But when you individualize the impact of this, it becomes much clearer, like, how huge this is.
Yeah, I mean, just seeing that he was getting emails about this and thinking about it even when he's overseas and not in the States, it's pretty freaky to see. The way it was written, it almost painted a picture of, like, in a way, like, being on the run from this stuff that's happening, and that's definitely not how it should be.
No.
Yeah.
Well, and it just shows we basically are putting enormous amounts of trust into these tech companies, and they try to address it, right? But that trust needs to be honored. especially when it comes to really, really key promises like this one.
Yeah, and it is really unfortunate that, like, on an individual level, there isn't too much that you can do in a scenario like this, but it's great that orgs like EFF or I think Mario mentioned the ACLU can also step in and help users that are affected.
Yeah, and I mean, some are, you know, pushing back on these and seeing how quickly the government folds when they're actually challenged on these really flimsy demands for data. So we like to see that. And I'm also, I actually am pretty encouraged that we talk a lot about a lot of different stories about government invading privacy. And this is one that it seems like people really sort of get. They understand what's at stake and how this works, where, you know, you criticize the government online and then they're going to a tech company, a social media company to try to get you, like, figure out who you are. It's alarming.
Hopefully we do see more companies honoring these promises. And I'm curious to see, like, what the outcome of our work is on this, mostly because, like, seeing how flimsy and, like, dishonest these subpoenas are, it's just, I don't know, this is such a frustrating issue in a way. The government has not proven that they can be trustworthy, but it's moments like this where it's just like, what are we doing right now?
Well, I think at the very least, the proper action, the proper recourse is fairly clear. Tech companies, tell your users if you get one of these. And more than that, fight it yourselves.
Yeah, totally. Quick break to remind you, EFF is a member-supported nonprofit, and your support is what makes this work possible. If you want to help fight back against tech companies sharing your data with immigration authorities, head to eff.org/podfan. For as little as $10 a month, you'll get our latest member t-shirt and join the community of over 30,000 EFF members fighting to make sure that technology works for everyone. That's eff.org/podfan. One more time, eff.org/podfan. All right, back to the show.
All right, I'm a little bit nervous. I've had the pleasure of quizzing Christian many times, but this is the first time I'm being quizzed by Christian. I'm not quite sure what to expect.
Yeah, this is my debut as a quizmaster, and I'm stoked and also slightly terrified that this is going to be a disaster, but we'll figure it out.
Okay.
So I'm going to quiz you, Hudson, on six acronyms that are like thrown around in EFF's work all the time. And I'll explain, like, my inspo about this in a little bit after the first acronym. But let's start. Okay. So our first acronym, I want you to tell me, what does FISA stand for? That's F-I-S-A.
Oh, no. I meant to study a little bit over the weekend and I totally forgot. This is going to be humiliating. Foreign Intelligence Services Act? Surveillance Act. No, what?
You're basically right. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So you did get it. I'll grant you the point. We mostly talk about FISA because of Section 702, which is up for renewal right now. There's a big fight on, you know, extending Section 702. 702 is basically the thing that allows the NSA to collect the communications of targeted foreign individuals. And, you know, the catch, there's always a catch, is that the American side of the communication is collected as well. So if the government is targeting someone overseas and they're talking to someone in the States, they collect all of those things. So, like, calls, texts, emails. And I think the scary thing about it, the thing that EFF fights a lot, is that the FBI is then able to search this database of communications without a warrant. We often call this, like, a backdoor search. So EFF has long called for reforms of Section 702. Bare minimum, the FBI should need a warrant to search this data, which I think, like, pretty easy ask, you know.
One would think. It's been a few years now, and it's been a long fight. It's pretty interesting, the exact moment we're in on right now, to see what happens with FISA.
Yeah, totally. And I'll let you know, the inspiration for this quiz is that I was reading the blog in bed one night, as one does, and I got to our 702 blog, and I was like, wait, what is 702 again? And I was like, kicking myself in the butt for not remembering off the top of my head. And I ranted about it at my wife for a little bit. She was like, you should just quiz yourself. And I was like, why not quiz Hudson?
It's a great idea. All right. I'm ready for the next one.
All right. Next one. What does DMCA stand for?
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Is that right?
You got it. Yep. Yeah. The DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This is a 1998 copyright law that EFF has a ton of history with. We typically push back on two main pieces of the DMCA, which is Section 512 that allows copyright holders to send takeout notices to platforms like, you know, YouTube, social media. We do a lot of work with creators on this issue. And then Section 1201, which is the anti-circumvention piece, it basically makes it illegal to bypass things like DRM on software and media that you own. So this can be especially hard for things like game preservation, digital media. As a bonus question, Hudson, do you know what DRM stands for?
Digital rights management.
You are right. Yeah. And as a gamer, you might know my hatred with DRM in video games.
Well, I think my ease with answering both of these comes from the fact that these are like much more sort of consumer facing. If you were a young person online in the late 90s, early 2000s, you had to engage a lot with the DMCA takedown stuff, things that you bought yourself having DRM that often like really just hobbled whatever sort of software you were trying to use.
Oh, 100%. As an aside, Capcom recently released Resident Evil 1 through 3 Classic on Steam. And I was like, oh, sick. I want those on my Steam Deck. That's going to be awesome. And they have DRM in them, you know, games that are nearly 30 years old at this point. And it hurts the performance on a 30-year-old game. So I'm upset about this right now. I won't rant for too long. Next up, what does CFAA stand for?
Oh man, I have nothing, Christian. What does CFAA stand for?
I'll admit I had to research for a lot of these too. This is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Of course. Oh my god. Yeah, fundamental. Okay.
Totally. I mean, if you're one of the security researchers that go to DEF CON, Black Hat, all that stuff, you know what the CFAA is. This is the federal anti-hacking law in the U.S. Basically makes it illegal to intentionally access a computer without, quote, prior authorization, whatever that means, because it doesn't define what it means. So the CFAA has long been used to prosecute people for doing things that you wouldn't even associate with hacking, like violating a website's terms of service, scraping publicly available data, security researchers doing security research, trying to find vulnerabilities in software. So yeah, it's something we've long called for reform on, and our lawyers often help a lot of these security researchers and hackers in court.
You know, I didn't think I had a lot of hacker cred before, but any modicum of that I had achieved is all like totally gone.
We got to get you at DEF CON. They'll loop you in. You'll get inaugurated. You'll just attend the lockpicking village. It'll be a great time.
Okay. All right. Let's see.
All right. Next one. We got a CDA or CDA 230.
Communications and Decency Act.
You got it. Stellar. Yeah. We often don't call it CDA 230. We just call it Section 230. This is the law that prevents websites, blogs, and forums from being held responsible for the speech of their users. We credit 230 as being the reason the internet exists the way it does today and that you can speak online. So, yeah.
I think the example that really drives it home to people is Wikipedia. Like, that wouldn't work, right? If Wikipedia itself was held liable for everything that anybody put on there, it would be basically impossible. And it's such an obvious public good.
Yeah, totally. Any type of challenges to 230, you can really think about all the small websites that don't have the funding to fight the countless lawsuits are just going to go away, you know? And I love me a small forum. Don't take those away, please. It's like last good thing.
It's the only thing that works. I don't, you know, we've talked a lot about you know, the problems and sort of impossibility of moderation at scale. But I think anybody who's engaged in any kind of online forum knows that, like, actually, like, the small ones are the only ones that actually function correctly.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Okay. Moving on. You got two left. next one, GDPR.
D is data.
Yes. Yes.
What's the G though? It's not grant. I'm giving up. Protection. I think P is protect. No, it's privacy. Oh my God. I'm giving up.
Yeah. This one is like, I was shocked when I figured out the acronym to this one. I've never heard what it stands for. General Data Protection Regulation, which, yeah, I guess. this is the comprehensive privacy legislation in the European Union. I think that the thing people, like, you know, consumers more forward facing will know about this law is this is like part of the reason that we have cookie pop-ups on websites and stuff now. Because now you know, get a heads up about the data that's being collected from websites and you are able to opt out or request that you be forgotten from a website, those kinds of things. Would be great if we could pass a federal privacy law here in the States, but not right now.
Yeah. And let's not completely blame GDPR for the cookie banners. There's a lot of ways this could be implemented, and it does seem that the industry has arrived at almost the most annoying imaginable version of giving people disclosure and control.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
Man, okay. I use all these acronyms, Christian, but like, do I know what they mean? And I'm increasingly finding out that the answer is no.
You'll get this next one. I believe it. FOIA. FOIA.
Freedom of Information Act.
Easy peasy. Got it. EFF loves FOIA. This is why you know this acronym. This is the law that lets journalists, researchers, and ordinary people request documents from the federal government. EFF uses this all the time. If you've ever visited our Atlas of Surveillance, which is our like database that tracks law enforcement surveillance tech, we often find out if law enforcement is using certain surveillance with FOIA requests. So yeah, I think what did you get? You got like 4 out of 6, I want to say. 3 out of 6? I wasn't keeping track.
I'll take 4 out of 6.
Honestly, there were some really hard ones here. Like GDPR, I would have never figured out that acronym. So kudos to you.
I just want to apologize personally to hackers and the continent of Europe. I failed both of you.
Yeah, hopefully this was educational for everyone. We throw out a lot of acronyms. Oftentimes just like, I don't even think about it. And then I'm like, wait, maybe they don't know what Section 702 means or something. So
especially with FOIA, I get really lazy because, you know, this is so impactful because allows you to request information from the federal government. But, you know, states, communities have their own public records access laws. But even when I'm talking about those, I'll often lazily just say like, oh, like FOIA your state government, even if you're using New York's sunshine law.
Yeah. And it is pretty easy to do these FOIA requests too. I think EFF does workshops sometimes, but you can also just go to like muckrock.com and makes it really easy to do. So you should FOIA your local government. Yes.
Yeah. And now, events and opportunities. Christian, how can people connect with EFF in the weeks to come?
Yeah, Cindy's book tour for Privacy's Defender continues. If you're in Brooklyn, New York, you can catch her tomorrow, April 23rd, at the Brooklyn Public Library alongside EFF board member Anil Dash. Then this weekend, April 25 through 26, you can catch EFF at B-Sides Charm in Baltimore, Maryland. You can stop by our membership table to chat about our latest work defending privacy and free speech online. And even grab some member swag while you're at it. And then looking a little further ahead, we're excited to be at RightsCon next month, this time in Zambia. We'll have a ton of talks covering our work on age verification mandates, law enforcement surveillance, and keeping AI accountable. Of course, you can learn more about all of these events and other ways to see EFF at eff.org/events.
Well, thanks, Christian. That's it for this week's Effector. Effector is a podcast by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. the leading nonprofit defending online civil liberties. Our music is I Dunno by Grapes.
EFF promotes digital innovation, defends free speech, fights illegal surveillance, and protects rights and freedoms for all. Become an EFF member today at EFF.org/podfan.